next 15 minutes or so for questions and answers.
Well, thank you guys for this talk. I think it's very informative. I'm going to sort of frame my question. I'm the trauma medical director at a level one trauma center that does not have a teaching program for ophthalmology. I've got good access to specialists, including retina, orbital, plastics guys, daytime. Nighttime is kind of tough. Most of the call panel is comprehensive ophthalmologists that don't feel comfortable, or they tell me that the physical exam that they can do in the emergency department is going to be inadequate. So what I have to kind of figure out is who do I absolutely need to transfer out, which is a big deal if you're a level one center, for a true eyes-on exam by an ophthalmologist, and who can wait maybe that 6 to 8 hours to be seen by an ophthalmologist in the morning. So I was kind of want to get a feel from the panel, maybe as we go down, the common things that I get told is the rule out ruptured globe. That's even a bigger problem for me than the ruptured globe. So maybe who can wait till morning if you have a high suspicion physical exam versus a low suspicion physical exam. The lacrimal duct, sometimes we get a lot, so I was curious on the optimal timing of diagnosis and repair of a lacrimal duct. And then there's a lot of myth, I think, outside the ophthalmology community on what is done with the retrobulbar hematoma. I can do the canthotomy, or as I learned today, I can do a cantholysis. But if the pressure improves but does not normalize, I think there's a lot of myth that these patients go to a university center to have the hematoma drained, and I can say, guys, that's not a thing. Can you kind of help me with who needs to be seen acutely and who can wait till morning?
So some wise attending when I was a resident pointed out that there are really a true tiny handful of ophthalmic emergencies, i.e., the patient is going to go blind over the next 90 minutes to 120 minutes. And I think that's what you're really worried about. And I think the number one in a trauma setting is compartment syndrome. Mm-hmm. I assume you agree with that. Just because you're talking, if the optic nerve or the retina is ischemic for, depending on the studies, 90 minutes, 2 hours, you know, even some of them show you can be out to 3 hours. It's like brain ischemia. Once you lose it, it's not coming back. So those patients need to have that managed. So I've had patients, you know, been called by outside ERs that are, you know, an hour away or 90 minutes away or 2 hours away by ambulance, and the helicopter's doing something else or whatever. And I, you know, talk to the ER doc, say, you've got to do the canthotomy, cantholysis. And if you don't, just remember that the standard of care says you should be doing this, and that as an emergency department physician or something, you know, you need to know how to do this. It's a basic skill. The sad part is, of course, I've had colleagues in our own community call me saying, I don't know how to do this. Can you come in, you know, and do this even if you're not on call or anything? So I think that's the number one. I don't know about you guys, but I mean, the ruptured globe, generally, you want to recognize it, I think, and protect the eye and get IV antibiotics on board and those kind of things. But often the repair is not necessarily going to take place in the middle of the night in an emergent setting many, many times. And I don't know how it works at your center. I mean, even, you know, at the two places that I trained, a lot of times, you know, over the weekend and stuff, people might come in. But if it was 3 a.m. and the ORs were opening at 7, nobody was getting rushed to the OR at 3 a.m. I think just recognizing that there's a high suspicion was important. Lacrimal injury, you know, that's one that I think is a little bit of a subject to debate. The sooner you can get a tube in and repair the lacrimal duct or canaliculi, the better. But that said, you don't get complete healing and scarring even within a couple of days. You'll get granulation tissue that you can debride. But I've had patients who've come in a week later who've had pretty significant lacrimal injuries who they thought they just had that little cut in the medial, and we've been able to probe through and put a tube in, and they heal up completely well. So I think there's very few true emergencies, but there's a lot of urgencies that you can see.
And the only, when you're speaking of emergencies, and I think of the broad scope of everything that was basically discussed during today's session, the only other area that actually may be even more acute than the surgical trauma issue is the alkali burn, acid, yeah. acid burn, chemical contact burn. That is truly an emergency. What Mark was saying, I would completely agree with. Swimming upstream, quite honestly, the lid and lacrimal issues are only urgencies. They're not really emergencies. I mean, studies have demonstrated that you can effectively and successfully repair lid lacerations upwards to 48 to 72 hours, even after their occurrence. So we actually kind of, because of the high vascularity of the head and neck region, we actually kind of violate the concept of delayed closure, if you will, just because we don't see those infectious processes that occur from other areas of the body that are more poorly perfused.
I was going to say, one other, and this just is because I don't see them as much now. Entrapped orbital fractures can be a true emergency because the patients can have an ocular cardiac reflex from the muscle pulling. The patient become bradycardic, severe vomiting, really just intractable. And if those muscles are left long enough that they become ischemic, then the patient can have long-term motility problems and ultimately need additional surgery. Those are really, really rare in my experience. I mean,
number one, they tend to be in kids or young adults because the bones are somewhat more elastic. And so what happens is you get these green stick fractures where in particular the orbital floor fractures and then immediately pops back up into what looks like completely normal anatomy, except for the fact that you have an inferior rectus muscle or an inferior oblique that's actually herniating down through the fracture. Some people call these the white-eyed blowout fractures. Primarily because the individuals come in, they don't have a whole lot of soft tissue injury. You don't see enophthalmus usually with them, but what you'll see is that, again, they're usually a young person. Their pain tends to be out of proportion to what seems to be the soft tissue damage, and just don't be fooled by, and they often might even elicit the oculocardiac reflex. They may have bradycardia and hypotension associated. High rate of nausea and vomiting as well on presentation. But again, they're not very common. But even there, is that truly, I mean, if he has exposure and access to an ophthalmologist by daylight, by daybreak, I'm not sure how many people, I mean, some people would take those individuals in the middle of the night.
Right.
Others would say, this needs to be the first case tomorrow morning.
Right.
So the only other thing that I would add to the list is intraocular foreign body. These can sometimes be metallic foreign bodies, especially if they're moving around inside the eye, they can cause more damage. And so one would want to try to go in and remove those as soon as you can. It's not necessarily an emergency, but certainly an urgent case.
I just want to make one comment. So it's interesting because our culture in New York is a little bit different just because there's so many residents around and attendings and that sort of thing, just because geographically. But I will say you can actually get a pretty decent, the comment that they might have made to you that they can't do that much in the emergency room. I've had a lot of situations in which the slit lamp's not available or that sort of thing. I think you can actually get a pretty decent exam as an ophthalmologist using the lights and lenses. Sometimes I'll use the lens to actually get a better look. So there are some things that we can actually, you know, see in the emergency department that, you know, not necessarily having all the equipment available. But I will say that if someone's not available in the evening time or just in daylight, sometimes sending photos is helpful if they're able to take a look at a photo that you can send to them. With respect to when you're suspecting globe ruptures, I will say that there are some, as I show, that are kind of occult in certain cases that can be hard to necessarily pin down, and you can miss them. So I think in that case, it's helpful to at least, if you suspect that there could be perhaps a globe rupture, even just getting like an OR, I don't know what your situation is, but getting the OR ready or kind of on call or ready to go in case, because as long as you can repair those, generally they teach us within 24 hours, you have the highest chance of reducing the risk of endophthalmitis infection. So they should be kind of repaired in a timely manner. You know, can wait a little bit for the ophthalmologist to actually get there, but I would at least get kind of the ball rolling with the OR and that sort of thing if you suspect it.
Hi, Christina Bermas Mesa, Arizona. We have an ongoing discussion right now between OMFS or Plastics, whoever's covering face, and ophthalmology and trauma about consults in cases of orbital fracture. Sometimes, depending on who's doing the face call, they're a bit more conscientious or maybe a little more concerned with the medical legal aspect of things, that they want every orbital fracture to have an ophthalmology consult, but you have arguments both sides. Are there a set of thresholds or injury patterns or anything that you could suggest to kind of help deal with this discussion?
I'm guessing we have a pretty similar strong opinion on that, that if you've had trauma bad enough to break your bones around your orbit, even though they're very, some of them are very thin,
right,
that I wouldn't want to be the one in court going, well, I never bothered to call the ophthalmologist because I assumed the eye was fine. And then, as we just heard, there's an occult posterior rupture or a rupture of the globe behind one of the extraocular muscles, which is one of the weaker areas that you can't really see and may not be this blowout, terrible looking eye. And we've had times for sure when I was a resident or as an attending plastics where they call me saying, oh, yeah, the ER called and said we had a fracture. We're seeing the patient, just letting you know there may be a fracture to deal with. And then they say, oh, well, we're going to put that off for a little bit because we do have a ruptured globe. And even less than that, or less obvious sometimes, is the hyphema issue, because the patient does fine, they have their fracture repair, and nobody's bothered to see them. 3 days later, their eye's in a whole lot of pain because the intraocular pressure is 60 and it's supposed to be under 20, and they're losing optic nerve fibers just from that high pressure. So I would argue every patient.
So so I have some colleagues who actually would, their belief is that all of those patients, even their fracture repair, should have the input of ophthalmology or specifically oculoplastics. I'm not sure I agree with that part.
You mean with having the oculoplastics do it?
Right.
No,
but
no.
We have some colleagues, I know, that would espouse to that. I'm not sure I agree with that.
No.
But I think that I would completely agree with what Mark says, because there's been multiple studies done over the past several decades that have looked at the incidence or the prevalence of ocular injury associated with facial fractures. And the number has not changed over about 30 years. It's almost always somewhere between 20 and 25% of patients with orbital and midface fractures have occult eye findings or occult or obvious eye findings. So to that end, I think every one of those patients needs to have an ophthalmic consult. And in particular, I think the consult has to come as early as possible in the post-traumatic setting, especially if they're going to go to the operating room for any other reason as well, let alone repair the fracture.
And it's also very difficult to get ophthalmology in, so that just really adds to the complexity
right.
of things.
But I mean, the problem, it also is protective for the surgeon doing it, because if that patient has a traumatic optic neuropathy because they've been hit here and have a big fracture, and the patient's like, oh, I can't see, they're swollen, it's hard to do that. At least if you document that the patient was hand motion beforehand, you know that you didn't do anything, or the facial surgeon did not do anything as they're passing a plate into the, any kind of repair device into the orbit. You can put pressure on the optic nerve. I mean, of course, on the consent form from when we do fracture repairs is that we can damage the optic nerve. So, I insist I'm going to have a visual acuity, of course, before that patient gets repaired. I'm going to know what their pupil looks like. I'm going to know all of this, because I don't want to be the one who, after the fact, has to say, well, I think their vision was fine. I think they're okay, but now they're no light perception or hand motion or anything like that. So, I mean, really, it's protective, but I agree, because we run into it as well. Just sometimes, depending on where you are, getting the ophthalmologist in is really difficult.
Okay, thank you.
Chandrakant Garode from India. I want to ask, in entrapment of an inferior rectus, floor fracture of the orbital disc, if you found after exposing the exposure that inferior rectus is due to trapping, it's gangrenous, or part of it is gangrenous, So do we need to debride that or leave it as alone? Or what will be happen after it, that patient will get a diplopia, and what to do in such cases? Or how to reconstruct them?
Are they entrapped radiographically or clinically? Because that's a important distinction. Yeah.
In exploration, operative, intraoperatively, if you found that after releasing that entrapped inferior rectus, it seems to be very blackened and it's like a gangrenous. So should we remove that part of or remove that rectus or keep it there, or what will be the further action?
So just out of curiosity, you're observing the inferior rectus muscle intraoperatively, and you're saying this is clearly not a normal looking muscle.
Yeah, correct.
What's the time frame that you're speaking of? Following trauma.
A week time, week or 10 days.
Okay. Because there's a couple of things that I would mention, and again, from the standpoint of things, it could be that you're looking at muscle that's ischemic. Another thing that can happen to a rectus muscle, an extraocular muscle, is that you could get a fairly sizable sheath hematoma. Mm-hmm. And they can look very large, they can look very black or purple. Yeah. And so I'm not sure in I've got the observation skills to be able to differentiate dead muscle. But then again, I'm trying to think if I've looked at something at about 1 week to say that. But I would suggest that I would probably not be an advocate for debridement. I would say that the issue is to make sure that the muscle is no longer entrapped. And in cases like that, I would probably, in addition to the usual postoperative care, I might actually place a patient like that on oral steroids for a couple of weeks with a tapering dose
to try to
minimize the amount of muscular fibrosis and cicatrix that will develop. And some of those patients will get better, some of those patients will not. And the ones that are left with some form of a restrictive dysmotility may be a candidate in the future for strabismus surgery.
And I think, there's a high likelihood, regardless if it's been that long, if they have a big hematoma.
What my doubt was, if that is like a necrosed tissue or a dead tissue, it's part of it, and if we leave that like that, after the post-surgical period, if it gets infected, or then what is there any chances like that?
I think you probably have a greater chance.
Because we are leaving a dead tissue inside. So.
Right. There's such a great blood flow. I think you have a greater chance if you place an implant in the orbit. You've got a chance just because you're putting something foreign there. But the necrotic tissue by itself, I don't think is as big of a risk. I think other parts of the body, absolutely.
Means we can put it. We can left like that only.
Right. I think leave it. And only because if you do debride it, the muscle is going to bleed a lot once you get to the healthy tissue. Then you're going to have to cauterize that to avoid more hematoma in the orbit, and you're going to damage muscle more. You're probably going to have a motility deficit anyway if you've got a piece of dead muscle. And then in the best case, you don't, because it was just a hematoma around it, and it ends up healing up okay. But if it's been entrapped for a week, my suspicion is most of those, you'll probably have some fibrosis and a reasonable chance of getting, a motility deficit.
In the post-traumatic setting, I'm not really sure that I've I'm not sure. I know for a fact that I've never had to go back in to debride dead tissue from an orbit, and I'm not really sure that I've heard of any colleagues who do it. The biggest thing that will happen in terms of post-operative or post-traumatic infection, a real warning is from the guy who tripped and fell on the vegetative foreign body. Right. Vegetative foreign bodies in the orbit can sometimes really be tricky to diagnose. It's one of those things of, if you're not thinking about it, you don't look for it, and so you miss it. And again, because we use CT scan most commonly, sometimes the vegetative foreign bodies can basically look like air. and they're often misdiagnosed as basically being orbital emphysema, when in fact what you have is a, you know, a pine branch, or the one that I took out a month ago was a chrysanthemum, a dried chrysanthemum stalk, that a little old lady fell from her walker and impaled into her orbit. So, I wouldn't, again, from my experience and from what I know, the experience of others, then I wouldn't debride the muscle.
Consensus is to leave that muscle.
I would
like
leave
that
it alone.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Excuse me. So we've had a lovely discussion, good, great talks. Unfortunately, we are over time, and we have to end this session. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you all for attending.
Thank you so much.